All right. So to start this off, and just to get a feeling how careful I have to be with what I'm saying. So how many of you have actually done any two-dimensional processing? So how many of you ever think that we'll do this? Okay, that looks good. And eventually you all will do it, okay? Because, you know, a single particle will go a certain way, but after that everybody will realize that 2D is the way to go. And so what I want to do today is I want to give you sort of a very cursory introduction on the philosophy and the principles of how you deal with a two-dimensional crystal. Now, it won't contain any math. It will be all very intuitive, and so you don't grab your handouts just right now, right? Because I first want to get an intuitive understanding of what two-dimensional crystal processing is all about before we actually look how it's done computationally. Right? And the wonderful thing for me is that I can start that entire lecture with a very good message. There's only one package. Right? So, and the reason for there only being one package is that the philosophy behind two-dimensional processing doesn't really leave you much choice what to do, right? With the single particles, you can play in different ways, and as you can see, if you're in a hurry, you just whip up the structure of your liking out of noise. You can't do that with the 2D crystals because there are just too many constraints in 2D crystal processing that's encoded in the phase information, as we see later, that completely tie you down, right, and determine how you do this. And there's only one way how you really can do this in a smart way, and that's why there's only one package. That package, however, is not annotated, has no GUI, nothing. So you do need to know what you're doing, unfortunately, and that's probably why so few people dare doing it. Okay, enough said to this point. So 2D crystals, right? If you want to define a two-dimensional crystal, right, if you were to do this in theoretical terms, you would say, well, it's a convolution between a lattice and a molecule, right? Now, knowing well that it's about 4 plus 9 or 5 plus 9, right, this probably doesn't speak to you. What's a convolution of a lattice with a molecule? Well, you're a very good example for this. If the human being were to be the molecule we were interested in, then you would make a lousy 2D crystal. Right? And why you would be lousy at the moment, because, you know, there are chairs and you properly convoluted one copy in each of the chairs. So why you're lousy is you would be able to see this if you could take a bird's eye perspective on yourself from the above. Right? So one of the things, although you sort of arranged in a more or less regular fashion, there's a lot of what we call disorder. For example, if I stay here and look straight, well, you know, this is almost like looking down this line after the fifth spear. Okay, so it's not really quite a straight line, right? So that's one of the problems. But there are other problems, and to just illustrate this, what we're dealing with in two-dimensional crystallography is I'm going to represent just one unit, right? So I sit myself down in a chair, right? And at the beginning of the week, you all were perfect, okay? So you were all attentive, sitting upright. Not quite ordered, though, an excellent why, right? Because you want to see what's happening in the front. But you were all upright and paying attention, right? Now, as the week goes on and the talk goes on, you know, certain things happen. You know, you find out you actually like your neighbor better than the speaker. So that's what you call rotational disorder. Now, rotational order on a lattice is something that, in principle, you could correct for. But let's face it, you know, if you're more interested in what's going on inside than what's going on in the main show, right, it's not really crystal, actually. So you're on the wrong boat there. So we don't actually do correction for rotational disorder. And then you have my personal favorite, right, so the sort of couch potato. Right? Now, that being a tilt of the molecule out of plane. Again, in a perfect two-dimensional crystal, you wouldn't expect that because there should be lattice packing contact that constrains the orientation of the particles on the lattice. It can happen, though, if you have a wavy carbon film, right, which sort of slopes like a roller coaster goes up and down, which will tilt all the units out and then come back down and whatnot, right? So that, unfortunately, is the thing we cannot really reasonably correct for. Right? That is one of the reasons why it was said if you work on two-dimensional crystal, you want your carbon to be just absolutely flawless and flat. Right? So that you don't get this sort of weird out-of-plane tilt. right? But so to reiterate this, so what we're dealing with is basically we have a sort of an ordered array, but there is actually quite a lot of heterogeneity locally going on. The lucky thing for us is that at least for the translational disorder in the XY plane, we can easily correct. Now, why can we correct for this? If you were asked, why would you be able to correct for translational disorder in the XY plane if you just not consider rotations in it, out of frame? Any ideas? Well, let's do this intuitive again. Go back to yourself as you're sitting here, right? Or just imagine yourself being a photographer. What you do is you stand in front of the crowd and you do this. You just move things, okay? So I pick a reference, right, Megan. So, okay, this is my unit cell. And I want all of you to align on a perfect crystal lattice with respect to that unit cell. And then I say, well, would you please shift to the left? Thank you. And you're pretty good. Well, you have to work it out, okay, because you're splitting my lattice here, okay? That can't be right. But so you basically can decide as you go along the lattice line with respect to a particular reference in your crystal area. And you can put things back into a crystalline register within limits. And what you achieve by doing so is that you basically have a lattice that is disordered and giving you sort of a diffuse diffraction pattern. You basically convert computationally into a perfect lattice that gives you a very sharp diffraction. Right? Now, the reason why you start with diffuse diffraction is that I can't describe my lattice by just a unit cell with certain unit cell vectors, but because you're wiggling, I have a bunch of unit cell vectors that are all slightly different. Now, if I describe that and have a mosaic, then what happens is that the diffraction actually gets sort of tapered out and loses itself in the background at some point. And by bringing everything back into the register, I collect the information that's in the transform and put it into the position where it should be. Now, that brings us to the first problem that you say, what is the Mortier transform, what's the Fourier transform of a two-dimensional crystal look like? And here you have no excuse. You all must know this because you've been talking about this for the past 2 days. Now, so this would be the picture, right? You've seen those before. Right? Could be a picture of anything. Which reminds me, I should be actually talking about one of the biggest differences, right, between 2D crystal single particles. You remember this was said before? What is one of the big differences between single particles and two-dimensional crystals? Well, in single particles, what you have to do is you have to find the particles, and you have to align them to average them. Now, in two-dimensional crystals, the crystal lattice takes care of the alignment. All of your molecules on your lattice are supposed to be in exactly the same orientation, bearing rotation and out of tilt, right? But all of them that are just should be in the same orientation. That makes it very easy for you to deal with this computationally because it eliminates the constraint that you actually have to see what you're looking for. Now, why would that be? In other words, the reason you don't see any, that is actually an extremely contrasty crystal image, right? It's beautiful. If you know what to look for, you see the lattice right away. You're not kidding. It's just noise. No, it's not. But, you know, you wouldn't be able to tell, but how can you tell that this is a crystal? Exactly, right? So what the last 2 days are all about is that you say in reciprocal space and Fourier transform space, right, we should be able to make a statement about the specimen. That being, you know, all your men in pajamas waving hands or just whatever you want. So what we can do as a very first step to convince ourselves we do have a crystal is we start calculating a Mortier transform, or calculating a Fourier transform of it. And this is how it looks like, right? Now, as I stated over class in this introductory lecture, right, once you see this, you get really excited. You see spots, and that gets you excited. Why? Well, it has different reasons. So the first thing it does tell you that is shared between all of the people, it tells you there's a crystal there. And then why you get excited about this different reason. As a graduate student, you're excited because you will graduate soon. Right? As a postdoc, you get excited because you will have a job. Right? As a PI, you will be excited because you will stay funded for a little longer. So there's all different reasons for being excited at that particular stage and seeing that you have a particular crystal. Now, let's try to understand again why that calculated transform looks the way it does. It shows you a wavy pattern of, you know, bright and dark things. And then you see these spotty things. Now, where does the spots come from? Why are there spots? Correct. Right? So because you have some molecules that have a blobby molecular transform sitting on a lattice, you sample that molecular transform at lattice points. In other words, what we are fortunate having in two-dimensional crystallography is you have all the information about the object that you need to retrieve eventually from, by the processing compressed into these tiny little spots. Everything else is just noise. It has nothing to do. In this case, it's caused by the carbon support film that you use to support your crystals on the electron microscope grid. But all that in between is not really doing a lot of, right? Now, that should give you an idea of what you can do as a very first trick, right, to improve the quality of that image. Any ideas? You can subtract the carbon, but how, sort of, how would you go if there was the right, you mask your transform, okay? Because in our case, we're not like the single particle people. In a single particle case, your information is more or less evenly spread everywhere. Right? In our case, we're very discrete. And all the information we need to reconstruct the periodic, that is the crystalline information in the image, is information that's contained in these little spots. So what we can do then is, as a first step, we can do what we call digital masking or digital image filtering. We take our transform, and we place a mask hole around the diffraction spots and write a new transform out on the computer, right, that will only contain the values within the mask holes, but is set to zero outside. Now that immediately will eliminate a lot of the noise that's obstructing or interfering with you seeing actually something nice. So in other words, if the collaborator comes and says, then all you do is you calculate the transform and you mask it, but how would you be masking to make your collaborator happy? So we know that that is a principle, but how exactly, you know, I mean, this is, it's a whole pretty big, right? Would you do that in order to just shoot? You could do that, but that is, you know, I'm too lazy, okay? This would take at least 20 seconds, okay? I need my answer faster, right? So if I want to produce a pretty picture, then I go again back to what you have, or exploit what you have learned about Fourier transform. If you have a perfect infinite crystal, your diffraction peaks would be very sharp. So in other words, in your transform, your diffraction peaks would be occupying only a single pixel, plus the spread to the reference light. Right. Now we can see that in the middle where the information is, that is where it's most intense, and then it sort of tapers off. Right? But if I just want to immediately produce a very pretty picture of this, all I'm going to do is I make this radius of the mask hole very small to just include the information that is on the exact predicted peak position for that particular lattice. And if I do this, that is what I'm getting. Right? So that looks a lot better than this. You still wouldn't necessarily use it as a wallpaper design in your living room, okay? But it will make your collaborator very happy, right? Because they see this to start with, and you show them this, and they think you can rock the world, okay? Just by going from here to here. Now, there is one caveat in doing that, though. And the caveat in doing a small mask hole is that you pretend to have a perfect crystal. In other words, all the information about lattice distortion is gone. And we have plenty of lattice distortion, as you've noticed here in this room. Right? So there's a lot of work for us to do, but we will not retrieve that in a pretty picture like this. So in other words, you have to decide, do I want to be pretty and have surgery, right? Or do I stay real and are useful? So these two options, right, you have. And intuitively, you know that you were able to play once you've seen how the image looks like that has been filtered with a larger radius of the mask. So in that particular picture, you still can recognize there's something periodic here. You still can recognize there's, well, whatever that is, okay? But it doesn't look as crisp anymore across the entire image, and that is to be expected. if we have a small mass plus radius, we basically say it looks the same everywhere. We just repeat whatever we have in, as information in the diffraction spot, add it up, and just plant it across the image. Now, if you have a bigger mass pool radius, then we start actually including information that lies off the expected peak position. Now, that is the information telling us about lattice disorder. And that also gives us immediately a handle how you can actually come up with a really smart strategy, how to tease out that lattice disorder and correct for it. You simply correct for it by producing a pretty picture and use it as a reference. That is what you're looking for. And you correlate it with the ugly picture that still contains the information of what you're looking for, but it's squished, it's spotted, you know, it's not in the right position and whatnot. And by comparing these two, picking a reference, and start aligning. That is basically how you can get rid of all these lattice distortion. And that is really all there is to it, right? So you basically start off as a transform. You generate a pretty reference, and you correlate it with the entire image. And that will allow you to determine how everything in your image is related spatially with respect to your reference. Now, once you know this, right, if I know that my expected peak position is here, but I'm blinded by something else, okay, then what I can do is I can just take that unit cell and say, you don't belong here, okay, just sit down and shut up, okay. So you go over here and you move it. And the reason we can do that, we come back to this a little bit more on Monday, is because images are just chunks of pixel values, right, and you have a certain number of pixels per pixel that describe your unit cell. Now, if that chunk of pixels is just not in the right place, you just take it, shift it wherever you want it, and then you patch it up, you know, a little bit so it looks smoother, so you don't get any ripoffs, and make sure that everything stays continuous. But that's really all there is to it, right? So the only chance we're having in 2D processing at the basic step is to determine how much every single unit cell within the image is offset with respect to a given reference point of your choosing. And the reason we can do that is because in our calculated transforms, don't forget that, we do have phase information. If we had the true electron diffraction pattern, for example, that would be useless because it doesn't, it's pretty, right? It's very accurate amplitudes, but it doesn't contain phase information. Phase information is what carries information about what is where in the image. Right? And the very reason for that is that if I ask Marco, describe to me where the transform is on the screen, well, he would probably come up and say, well, sort of in the left bottom corner. And as trivial as this is, that is basically phase information, okay? It's picking a point of reference and describing arrangements within a real space object as a function of shift or positioning with respect to an arbitrarily chosen origin, right? And that is what constitutes phase information, actually. And since we have it in the transform, that is what makes us lucky that we can actually exploit the phase information in the transform to determine what the shifts are. What we get then is, so how we do this, for that we need to go back a little bit to correlation functions. So now the question is, how do we determine that, right? We do that with correlations. And so Michael has done that very nicely in his lecture already, so I can go quickly over it, is that if you have a one-dimensional section or line through your unit cell, right, and you look at the optical density distribution in there, and you have a second copy, and you align them precisely in register, they're perfectly superimposed. So if you were to call that perfect and give it a correlation value of 1, and do the same thing that you now take one of the copies and you just shift it over one direction and in the other direction, and you plot how much overlap, how much similarity do you still find between these two curves, you find that there will still be some, but it will be less than perfect. So in other words, by calculating autocorrelation function, you always will receive a function that looks like this. It's basically a blobby sort of feature that has maximum right in the middle where there is zero translational movement between the two identical copies, and then it monotonously falls off to zero. If you ever calculate an autocorrelation that has negative values in it, you did something wrong. right? Or you need to curve it because it's not possible, physically not possible. So that is pretty easy, but it also will make you appreciate that by doing something we call cross-correlation, we can actually determine two parameters, right? Now let's take the profile for our reference area that we've picked from our crystal and compare it to just an arbitrary unit cell somewhere on the lattice that had that sort of cross-section, because we have noise. Don't forget that. Then what you find is that you still will get a sort of bump that has a maximum somewhat in the middle, but it won't be one, right? Because there is not a perfect superposition compared to correlating the object with itself. It just has less similarity. So in other words, what we can do is the autocorrelation will tell us how well and what that maximum value is going to be if we arbitrarily set to 1. If we then start cross-correlating that with the real objects on the lattice, what we will find is that there is correlation to a certain extent, but the correlation will only hit its maximum value, right, if we have a precise, exact copy. Right? So it will, in other words, only be maximum in the point where we actually do choose the reference area, because if you superimpose a reference with itself, you basically have an autocorrelation peak. But as you start shifting the reference out, looking for the similarity of other unit cells and where they are, you'll find they're sort of, they look somewhat similar, right? But not exactly. And that is why the cross-correlation, one part of information we gain from the cross-correlation is how similar every single unit cell on that lattice is actually to the chosen reference. Does that make sense so far? But there's one thing that we also can generate, and that is actually the information we are after, more so than the similarity, and that is what is the actual offset in real space. And that is shown here. Just suppose you have two identical copies again. With respect to that fixed origin in the middle, you'll see that you start with some sort of correlation value that is not unsimilar to this situation. But now as you start shifting the second copy this direction, the other direction, there will be a certain shift denominated by delta x for which the two fall into perfect register. That basically means that the maximum of your correlation peak is just shifted by a certain distance along x. And that shift along x is basically the amount by which the unit cell is out of register with the reference. And that is basically all we do. We basically determine by a cross-correlation approach how much, right, is every single unit cell shifted away from its predicted peak position, and we put that in computer memory, because then we just have to do the homework and shift everything back onto its predicted position, yes. Well, so here's the thing. So as a precise number, it won't, because what's happening is that the translational offset you will see, but you can't deconvolute this. So if you have something translationally shifted, it's perfect, you get a very nice peak that's just shifted. If it's a pouch potato, so it's tilted out of plane, then its projection actually looks different from what you see in your reference. And what that will look like is more like a peak that's in position but doesn't really agree with the reference area. Right. It may be a combination between, depending on how much it's tilted out, but with this particular specimen, the gap junction, for example, if you look at it end-on, six-fold symmetry, you tilt it by a half degree, you have no symmetry whatsoever, right? And that is because it's a very large molecule. Well, 1 degree, but it's a very little tilt. But to go back off this is that you say, well, we can calculate an autocorrelation thing which gives us some sort of a description of what the correlation peak looks like if we just correlate two identical copies of our units now. And then we can go roaming and do a cross-correlation, which will tell you how similar each of the unit cells is and how much offset it is. Now the question is, in practicality, is how exactly are you going to go about doing this for each of the unit cells? And this is where, you know, some 5 or 10 years ago, there was a second package out there that people had to learn. And they did it in a way that, you know, you would do like in a single particle world. You would chop off your reference area, and then you would shift it by one unit cell and do the calculation, and then shift it by another unit cell and do the calculation, and the third one, and the fourth one. So in other words, you take your reference area And for every single predicted position on the lattice, you would calculate the correlation function in real space, which is haunted by noise. Very tedious. And that's why it died. Okay? So what these people were doing in their package is they were actually doing a real space convolution. Right? So they take the reference convoluted with every single unit cell by shifting it around into every other position on the lattice and calculating these numbers. Now, if you're smart, you do this in a different way. If you know that what you have to do in real space is a convolution, what do you have to do in reciprocal space to achieve exactly the same thing? Exactly. So you have to do multiplication, right? So that's the beauty about having phase information and the transform is that we can actually do just a multiplication between the Fourier transform of our reference area and the complex conjugate of the Fourier transform of the image. And in a single calculation, you have determined everything. You're just done, right? Computationally, you're talking about 5 seconds versus, you know, half a minute. It's not that it matters, you know, drinking a cup of coffee is 5 minutes. So if that is your time scale, it doesn't really make much of a difference. But if you think about it, dealing at a large scale with many images, it actually is more elegant to do it in reciprocal space. And that's why it prevails. Now, just to show you examples of how these peaks look like, is that is the typical autocorrelation peak, how it looks like. It's just a featureless block. That is basically just a portion of the cross-correlation map of the crystal, where we've taken the crystal transform, multiplied it with the transform of the reference area. And what you see is you see basically the same feature in here that you see in here. And that is what now allows you to very easily read out what these distortion vectors are going to be, because I just take this as a search model. In this very strongly simplified and denoised map, right, start out here and say, well, I hop one and I find my peak. I hop one, I find my peak, right? And then you hop one and ouch, the swimming pool was empty, okay? So you hurt your ankle when you land on the concrete, right? So the lattice just shifted. So you have a translational disorder. But you have a search model, what you're looking for. I'm the autocorrelation peak, and I'm seeking something similar, the cross-correlation peak. So I just are being moved around that original position in a, not a random walk, it's a directed walk, until I hit the cross-correlation peak, and then we just made. So I know, okay, this is where you are, and I put that position down into memory. And then I just jump to the next unit cell, hoping that I will be landing on the right position. If I don't, well, I just wiggle around that position, eventually will find the peak, put that into memory. Then I jump again. Right? So one by one, I basically then read out the search of the cross-correlation map and put into memory the positions that I've found for the actual XY coordinates of the cross-correlation peak. So the way how we summarize this in a pretty way so that you can remember that is we come up with these sort of plots. They come in two parts. The first part is actually the one that we're interested in, and it will actually look much better in your handout, actually. That transfers very badly. This is a representation of the distortion vectors in your lattice. And starting at the reference where you're on perfect register, you will just find a dot because there is no displacement. But as you start moving away from the reference, you will see that there are sort of offsets, right? And if you have a true crystal, these offsets will be smooth. In other words, if you have a cross-correlation readout here that tells you, you know, one dispersion vector runs off that direction, and then like a headless chicken, right, the next one goes this way, and then for the third you go straight, and then you turn around and you go this way, then you know something is not quite right. Like, you know you have a diffraction pattern that has to be a crystal, but it will be tipping you off that your processing is not doing what it's supposed to do. So you have to just fiddle with parameters a little bit. But what you see here is that you say, well, it looks like we have a smooth scenario right over here, and then there's nothing here, and then you have some sort of a chaotic pattern over here. Now, what turns out the cross-correlation cells tells me is that is where my crystal was, and there's just a piece of carbon film, because I just happened to digitize the part of the crystal that was really the best. Right, there's no point in processing a lot of garbage. So I just color it. And the way how the scanner here set up, the Perkin-Elmer scanner, right, I just had it set up that it was scanning a little piece of carbon film. But by cross-correlating this, using a reference area that's generated from the crystal, I can clearly tell carbon film from a crystalline part. Right? And that in itself is a valuable piece of information because what it does allow me is to use this type of plot where I basically plotted how well each of the unit cells that I have encountered in my cross-correlation search corresponds to the reference that I chose originally. That now tells me the darker the plot symbol, the better the agreement. So remember when we were doing the cross-correlation, we could determine the height and the offset. Now that is the offset, that's the height. So I probably should have done them in the same order, but I have to keep you awake somehow. So let's twist it here. So this basically tells me how good every part is, and that tells me how far off it is the expected position. Now there comes another beautiful thing that the X-ray crystallographers die for if they could only do it. Right? I know where my good cells are. So I can just box them out. So I can just place a box around the good part of my crystal and pad everything else with zeros on the outside I'm not interested. Because everything that's out here contributes to the background, it doesn't contribute any signal that is periodic. Right? So what I could do in the next processing step actually is draw a box here, set everything to zero out here, and then calculate the Fourier transform, which is only generated from the very best part of my image. Right? And on top of that, I've corrected that image before boxing. Right? That means I have taken these offset vectors and shifted every single unit cell back into register with a perfect lattice. Okay, so that's basically all there is to it. And what it does is this, again, apologies for the bad transfer here, is that if you look at the singleton race ratio in the diffraction spots before you do what we call lattice unbending or lattice straightening, you find that it tapers out at about 15 angstroms. After we've done the corrections, identified what parts of the crystal we actually want to use, the resolution goes all the way out to 7, right, if not better. In this case, it wouldn't be much better because I didn't digitize it finely enough to actually go much past that cutoff. But it tells you that by computationally improves the crystal quality, we can actually restore a lot of information and exploit a lot of information that is really in my image. But sort of distributed because of disorder. And by getting rid of the disorder computationally, I can restore the power to the fraction. And once I have done that, I'm basically all set. Okay, now comes the thing that you all hate, I2, right? So the CTF, right? This is the next thing. Now we know what the diffraction spots are and how they look like when they're corrected. Now we have to correct for this. And I will just impose that on you how we do this and then talk on Monday more about actually from a different point of view what CTF is, where it comes from, right, and how it impacts on the way how we should be taking our images actually. So let it just be for the moment that we say, well, we're looking at phase object and, you know, all the frequencies explain certain phase shift and then the objective lens does something to it, which results in this funky modulation of the transform, right? So Steve was referring to it as a filter yesterday, and we've heard about this from other people. So what it actually is basically a function of spherical operation, the fraction angle, and the amount of underfocus that we're using. And on Monday, we'll come back to that figure, and I hopefully will be able to explain that to you in a way so that you really understand what that means, right? But we don't have quite the time right now. The point I want to carry home is that this thing is the tone ring oscillation you saw in the background that was superimposed on the diffraction spots. Right? Has nothing to do with our structure, but it royally screws it up. Right? And the reason why it royally screws it up is because in every single node where you have a negative value of that filter, your phase is flipped by 180 degrees. Now, physicists to the front. Flipping a phase by 180 degrees means what? Negation. What else? Exactly. So you reverse the contrast, right? So instead of wearing a green shirt, I would be wearing the opposite. That would be a red shirt. Okay. So in other words, what you image black on white here, it would be image white on black on that node. And that is pretty unhealthy, even if you don't really understand a lot about how image formation works and so. But not imaging everything with the same contrast is troublesome. And we have to correct for this. And the reason we have to correct for it is that at the end of the day, we not be done with taking a single image. We have to combine data from a variety of images because in contrast to single particle work, a single image only provides us with a projection of a single view. Beautifully averaged, but only a single view. So if we want to restore the three-dimensional information from an object like that in projections, we have to tilt, as you will see later. So we need many images. And we also have to compensate for the fact that there are zeros here, so we have to record images at different sort of filtering levels for the defocus value. And that basically means that suppose you're a frequency that's sitting here with a certain value. So I have a certain phase here, and now I record that as a different underfocus, let's say left underfocus, that would shift that zero out. So all of a sudden, that same frequency lands here. Well, for simplicity, in this node, the frequency would have a phase of 180. Same frequency, same image, everything, same object, and that node would have a phase of 0. If you average the two, you can do that. You get 90. So you get a random value. And that's not going to work. Right? So in order to have an ability that you can combine data from multiple images, you need to have them corrected for the CTF to assure that the contrast for all frequencies is the same in all of the images. And the reason why that is absolutely critical for us is because the alignment of our images, as we will see in a few moments, is driven by phases alone. We never look at the amplitudes. The amplitudes are just a proof, okay? So you can take a paintbrush and just paint the amplitude. It doesn't really make a whiff of a difference what the amplitude is. It's the phase that carries the information. And since in 2D crystallography, you use the phase for everything, right? We have to correct for it, because otherwise we get stuck in our alignment of the images. All right. So how would we do this? Yeah, well, you know, if you're a dinosaur like I am, you do this the old-fashioned way. You just go into your calculated transform, you see the toning modulation very nicely because you have a continuous amorphous substrate, the carbon film there. You just measure the length of that vector to the first zero. And then you calculate what's in reciprocal space that is in one over Angstrom. And since the CTF has a defined form for the, you know, how this function looks like depending on the defocus and, you know, the angle on this, we can simulate that, right? So once I know where the first zero is in reciprocal angstroms, I can just match it with a set of reference curves until I find a reference curve for an underfocus where the first zero coincides with the same position. That's my underfocus. And being very lazy, I just give that away and say, that's the underfocus, and I can deal with any fine tweaking later. That's beautiful in the 2D crystallography stuff because, again, everything is driven by phases. The phase will just tell you exactly how you have to correct for astigmatism and defocus. Then you just plug it in, right? So that would be the simulated rotationally average pattern symbolized by the rings, and you see how the diffraction maxima actually distribute themselves on these different nodes. This is negative contrast, positive contrast, negative contrast, positive, negative contrast, positive contrast. And I can keep telling you this, right? And in your brain, you just have a small little black box where it has a dust button on it, right? So it doesn't really evoke a picture. Why do I have to do that correction? Well, that is illustrated here. Now we go back to the pretty wallpaper that we had calculated in the beginning by just very tightly masking our transform. Now, if we use the transform values at phase value, that means as they are modulated by the contrast transfer function of the microscope, we get this. But then that has nothing to do with our object, really, right? Because two-thirds of the components are in there with the wrong contrast. So after I've corrected for the CTF, I actually get a picture of what my object actually looks like, right? And the ones that are sitting in the front, I hope you will agree that this looks different from this. If you can't see this, you're in the wrong course, okay? Get up and leave, right? It's a minimum requirement to participate, okay? So in here you see absolutely no detail, whereas here you can actually see the individual gap junction channel sitting on the night lattice. There's a hole in the middle, you start seeing some EDCs. That is what CTF correction does for you, okay? And that is why we need that, because by flipping the contrast of the components appropriately, all of the images now will start looking similar. Whereas if I were to make a gallery of the image at different defocus values, you would see that it just all looks different. If I start averaging, I just get a beautiful gray square that has absolutely no information in it whatsoever. All right. Let's recap that. So what have we done? Right, so you successfully unwind your first image. What you do is you start off with a digitized raw image, and you calculate your lifeline, the Fourier transform. Then you calculate a digitally filtered image with a small radius to give you the reference area. And from that reference area, you also will calculate the autocorrelation map to give you a search object for your cross-correlation map later. But then, you know, this is real space. So we can't really do any efficient calculations in real space as far as the distortion fraction, everything is concerned. So we hop back into reciprocal space and just calculate the Fourier transform of our reference area. And that is really the key of it. Then we take the mass Fourier transform of the raw image where we have imposed a very large mask radius. And that is, that transform will still contain all the information about lattice distortion. And by multiplying these two together in reciprocal space, we actually obtain the Fourier transform of the cross-correlation map. All we have to do is convert that back into the real space cross-correlation map. And we have a search object generated from the reference area, so we can actually search our cross-correlation map for the position of the cross-correlation peaks. Once we have that, we plug that in with the original image and just reinterpolate the image to shift all the units down to perfect register with our reference. Yes? Actually, just so it depends on what you want to hear now, okay? So I can give you sort of an answer that will satisfy you, but it's not the full truth. So what will satisfy you is that you can actually go in there, you calculate the filtered image, and you just look where does it look best, and you pick that at the center of your reference area. Okay. As a matter of fact, it actually turns out that in this particular procedure, you can calculate your autocorrelation map from a piece of carbon film from a different image, and the whole approach still works. Gives the exactly same answer. Right? But we don't have to go into this right now. The people who take the 2D quest for practical, I'm perfectly happy to talk about. Yeah. Well, that's what you do. Well, yeah, you could do a peak search, right? But the problem is, so what Ron said, you could just be naive and just say, show me where the highest points are, right, in that map. And the highest point should be where the cross-correlation peaks are. Right? Now, the reason why you don't do this is the reason why you actually go in there with the autocorrelation map is that that allows you to do a peak fitting. If you just say, tell me where the highest pixel is, if you have a near atomic resolution map, you know, your correlation peaks will be extremely sharp and high and extremely well defined. For the membrane protein people and all the people that work on 2D crystals, reality is that your crystals are pretty lousy in most cases. And not really all that high resolution in most cases. That means the correlation peaks are, you know, going out of shape like most guys in the mid-40s, right? They just lose it in the waste. So they're sort of ballooning. Now, if you have a cross-correlation peak like this, you can't just look for where it is because you will be off. And the objective here is that you actually, what you want to determine is you want to determine the position of the correct, of that peak maximum to a fraction of a pixel. Now, why would you want to know this to about a hundredth of a pixel or a thousandth of a pixel, given that the unit cell is, let's say, 50 pixel big? Well, your crystal is, if you're lucky, 200 unit cells long. Now, if I'm off by a tenth of a pixel with my peak position, and I have times 200, that basically means that the unit cells over here are sort of unbent, but not really quite, so that I still have curvature in my lattice, because I can't completely compensate. If I nail my peak position to a thousandth of a pixel, then I can have a very large range, actually, for correcting and still be perfectly straight, right, in the alignment. That's one of the reasons why you want to have a really good accuracy to minimize long-range disorder after band bending process. All right, so we have done that, and then what you do finally, really, in the very end, is you take your unbent image, calculate the Fourier transform, you hop to the expected peak position, and you read out a list of amplitude and phases. Yes?
Not normally, and
Well, that in a way, you know, we're not really interested in maximizing any correlations. We're not, right? We just take what's there. No, see, so where I'm getting lost, right, is maximize the cross. I don't do this, right? So what I'm going to do is that I just calculate a cross-correlation map, okay? And I don't bother about normalizing the variance and whatnot. I just calculate. Well, as it actually turns out, you can take an autocorrelation profile from a different film and a piece of carbon that has no structural information about on the thing. It still works just beautifully fine. It defines the crystal and everything, okay? Because the whole philosophy behind this, right, and why it works. Am I supposed to close? Yes. Okay, we do. Okay. I can stop here. Okay. So, but we discussed it over coffee, okay? So here's our original image, and this is what we have done. Right, with all that. We've basically decomposed it in a list of H and K amplitude phase, a quality factor that tells us how much above the noise level we are, and a calculated number for the contrast transfer function. Now I have them pink and yellow, right? So the one in pink basically, they have a negative sign, and the ones that are in yellow, they have a positive sign. So what I have to eventually do if I start comparing images, I have to add 180 degrees to the phase of all the ones that are in pink, because they're just out of contrast. Right, they're flipped, to make a real object. And as you can see, that is a pretty straightforward determination in our case to determine what needs to be flipped and what needs to be done. Okay, have that. Now we're going on. Now we have an image, and the question is, what do we do in terms of the crystallographic processing? We want to generate a structure in the end. And the beauty about crystals is that most of them have a relatively large amount of symmetry, and that is sort of shown here. What we talk about symmetry, this is a simple example. You know, if you have a pretty face, you can actually delete half of this, right? Because you can always regenerate the other half by applying a mirror operation. That, you know, since the Greeks, right, that is the definition of beauty. And that is what we're basically looking for in our crystals. We look for some beautifying element. That being rotational axes or two-fold axis that rotated around within the plane or whatnot, right? Now the question is, how would we ever be able to identify symmetry in our crystals? Remember yesterday, Ron showed all these optical transforms, and there was a thing about three-fold and six-fold, and so what was actually the difference between the three-fold and the six-fold? Do you remember that? Good. And you're getting the hang of it, right? So this is a magic word. Phases, phases, phases. And that doesn't mean, you know, you're a toddler one time in your life and then a teenager. So not this sort of phase. You have actually phase values attached to your structure factors. And if you have a particular symmetry, there are predictable relationships between the phases of the different structure factors. So all you have to do is have to look for what part in the unit cell do the predicted phase relationships hold up? And then you just pick the symmetry that holds up the best. Right? So we were talking about this a big detail, right, in the crystallography practical. We don't have much time, but the same principle and sort of applies for combining data from different images. It's again the phases that drive our alignments. And the way we do this is we take one image, determine what its symmetry is by looking for phase constraints that are compatible with symmetry in the crystal lattice, and then bring that image to its crystallographic origin by applying a phase shift that shifts the unit or unit cell to wherever it needs to be so that it is actually obeying the crystallographic symmetry. Right. So in other words, you know, that, well, I'm losing you, okay? So if that was a two-fold axis, I need a partner here. Can somebody volunteer to press them up? Okay, this is our two-fold axis for a moment. And it goes perpendicular. But you stay on the other side, please. No sitting. No, getting hemorrhoids otherwise. No, don't want that. So if we arrange perfectly, right, on the twofold axis, you actually have to face the other way. Turn around. Turn around. More. That, okay, so it's like in school, you know, that. Okay, so now we have a sort of twofold axis here, right? We can generate the other half by just swapping places, right? We're not going to do this because you might not get the point. But what the idea is that you say it will only happen in the unit cell if we aligned next to the twofold axis. In other words, right, if you step away from the twofold axis, yeah, that would be difficult, okay, but I follow. Okay, so don't go away, just stay. Now we're in our unit cell, but we're not on the twofold axis. Right? That would be the only position in our arbitrary unit cell where if we apply 180 degree rotation, we'll translate this. But if we're not centered about that axis, then we basically have a P1 lattice. But what we can do is we can take the unit cell contents, like the two of us, and systematically shift it throughout the unit cell by applying phase shifts. Right? Remember, phase shifts are translations in real space. And we do that across the entire unit cell until we hit the position that is centered about the twofold axis in the unit cell. Right? And at that point, all the phase relationships that are in place for twofold symmetry will be obeyed. So we can just average there, right then. Right? Now, once I've done that for one image, I've centered it perfectly about its symmetry axis. There is no reason why I can't do this to any pair of images, right? So if I were to pick on another pair of volunteers here and just place them over there, if you want to align these two images, all you have to do is you have to identify what phase shift you have to introduce to the set of phases that will translate that pair over to where we are. And then we have a foursome to get to that, right? And then you take the third image, which may yet be in a different position. We find out what are the phase shifts that we require to shift it onto the symmetry axis, and so on and so on and so on. Thank you. So that is basically what we do. We create a reference image that is centered about its crystallographic origin. Then we take the phase sets of other images. We all sort of shift them by determining what phase shift we need to apply to move them to the crystallographic origin with respect to the first image. And then this wiggly sort of stack of pancakes then gets sort of relatively shuffled, so you just stack it up really nice and tightly. And once we have all the images, that means the phase sets in the same position, we just average the numbers. Right. But once we've done that, we then generate this. Yep. You only can do this for now, right? We still untilt it. We have no tilt, right? So what we do is we basically generate a projection map that is now averaged from several images where you have HK and L, L being zero because we're not looking at three-dimensional contents at the moment. We have an amplitude phase figure of merit for the quality of the phase, and we can invert that basically by just summing all these things up. That is your cooking recipe, okay? So if you make a turkey to Thanksgiving, this is what you do. You take a turkey, no, actually you take this, this must be the turkey, it's the biggest ticket, right? Then you take some salt or some stuffing, and then, you know, so that basically just tells you, right, how much of each of the components you have to take and put together in your Fourier summation of the different curves. Sines and, in this case, cosines, right, because all real, to add up with this. This is simply the sum of all these numbers, right? And then we're done. So then we have basically carried through for the untilted case from individual images, lattice unbending, getting the data, averaging the data, and all that sort of things, right? Now, the 2Ds will be two slides. Now we have to go into three dimension. And the way how we go into three dimension is that we take our two-dimensional crystals and we tilt them inside the microscope. And the people in the front row are rewarded because they can tell that by tilting this and projecting, we generate really weird-looking objects. Now those are simply the just one, two-dimensional projections of the tilted crystal lattice. They don't look as pretty in sixfold, but that's okay. In reciprocal space, that all makes sense, and that is how we combine them, right? Because remember, so each of these individual images, tilted projection, is just one plane in the three-dimensional transform of the object, right? So our next task then is to basically identify the pairwise common lines that link these different views. And once we have that, we basically know all about how to combine them and reconstruct the object. That brings us back to actually one more after that. That brings us back to the concept, what is a Fourier transform? So I told you, we're lucky that if we look at the image of a crystal, we have a two-dimensional diffraction pattern, spots. Now the question is, does that also apply in the third dimension? Any takers? How does our Morse transform look like in the third dimension? It's continuous. Has to be continuous because we only have a single layer. So we have the single layer ordered in the XY plane, and that is why in the XY plane we get a discrete sample diffraction pattern. But along the third dimension, we're continuous. We only have a single copy of the object, so we're not sampled. We have a continuous distribution of amplitude and phase values going up the third dimension. That's illustrated here. So if discrete diffraction spots, but if we start tilting, we're basically sampling the transform along points of the continuous transform in the z-direction. Right. And by determining all the plane orientation and tilt angles, we basically know where these things, these what we call lattice lines, have to be sampled. And then we can average from those points and figure out what it is. So just to prove the concept, this is how it looks like. Right. Now what I've done here is I've taken just one of these reflections, right, and turned them through 90 degrees, right, so it's easier to look at. So the z-axis that goes up here now will be going out that way in the next figure. And what you do see is that the experimental phase values and amplitude values are indeed just scattered continuously, right? And that is why we need to, depending on how thick our specimen is, carefully select what sort of tilt angles we have to sample. We just have to collect enough experimental data points that will allow us to do something required for computational analysis, right? If you were to feed that data distribution into a computer as is, a single lattice line would be a limitless number, right, of individual values. So a computer wouldn't like that. What the computer likes is nice, discrete sample points. And that is what we also want to generate because our structure is nice and sample, has a defined envelope, right? So that is what we can do is once we have enough individual measurements, we can just fit curves and determine what the thickness of our specimen is, or just guess what the thickness of our specimen is, and look up what the phase values and amplitude values are along these fitted curves for each of the orders in the third dimension. And what we wind up with is what crystallographers have, a list of HK and L with amplitude and phase and an assessment of the quality of the phase, and that then will allow us to go from this point here where we just had a single projected view to this point where we can actually calculate the three-dimensional volume, right? So here you now have dimensionality in it by combining the data from the tilted images with simple projection, and that gives three-dimensional structure, you know, one cell here, and then the gap junction with the channel and, you know, the sausages. Now, if you were to look at this from the top, you'd see just the simple projection that we've shown, right, in the image that we used as a test case for demonstrating it. And then you have different ways of playing with this, right? I mean, if you like graphics, you do this, right? You zoom in and you look at the individual helices or atoms or whatever when you have higher resolution, or you can cross-section it and look at individual heights. So in other words, at that stage, we really have genuinely retrieved three-dimensional information about how the density is changing as a function of height rather than just the XY position within your unit. And with that, we're done. So if you calculate this 42,000 channels here, that translates to, well, we have 40,002 channels times 12 in the channel, right? It's about 500,000 molecules. So in the 2D case, right, if you have 500,000 molecules, you can go to somewhere between 5 and 7 angstrom. So which is not really all that different from what you would have for single particles, right? The difference is once we extend it to about 10 million, I think, we can actually go all the way to near atomic with the 2D, which for the single particle still has to be shown. And on that, I just close. They want coffee. Well, you usually wouldn't, right? Because usually wouldn't, because your correlation peak is a function that monotonously falls off. So it doesn't look really like this. It still has some sort of, if your object is six-fold, it has a sort of six-fold modulation in the correlation pattern, right? But the subsidiary maxima, right, are a lot less strong than your central peak where you have the entire... Yeah, because if you have a crummy unit cell, right, then your subsidiary maxima also go down, right? There will not be quite as matching either, right? So it's all basically on a relative scale to each other. So that's why. Right, but what you have to be careful is that if you have images of very highly tilted crystals, then your diffraction is not isotropic. It's usually better along the tilt axis than it's perpendicular to the tilt axis. So if you calculate correlation functions from that, you actually get dips that create negative ripples. And if you include those in the phosphorylation analysis, then you get actually the wrong distortions, because these negative values that can actually be quite powerful in driving where the peak alignment goes. Yeah. Well, see, the big problem is that actually it doesn't really work that way. So if you take individual molecules, right, and we were to just build them into a crystal, you would get a sort of a crystal lattice, right? But the big problem with that is that you actually do a deliberate alignment parameter, so you don't really retrieve information about the actual distortions in there. And there will be distortions in there, even if you perfectly try to rotationally align them. So if you have a vesicle, like, and you do a free spike trans, you see there's lots of vesicles, right? Then, yeah, in a perfect world, if you could take all of them and you could perfectly align all of them into a 2D lattice, right? What you would do then is you could diffract that, and that would give you the information you want, right? The problem is that your signal-to-noise ratio in the single particle will not allow you to actually determine how you should be rotationally aligning it. That doesn't make too much sense, right? Let's talk about this over coffee. That's the longest thing, because we had that. Yeah. Correct. Well, this depends on what philosophy you say. If you were Richard, you would say, go back to the bench, make a better crystal, right? But yeah, in principle, yes, if you could come up with a subroutine that will do a rotational alignment after the translational alignment, you might be better off, but then you would have to iterate that particular step. And the big problem is that the translational you can do in reciprocal space simply by doing the rotational you would have to do in real space, which is computationally more expensive. No. Yeah? Well, the problem is, why on the planet would you want to do this, right? not because there's something wrong with the single particle, but if you have the power of crystallography averaging, right, why would you want to give it up? In the next contribution, electron diffraction. So electron diffraction you do probably in 0.01% of all cases that you will be exposed to, right? Because it requires you to have a crystal that's large and well-ordered. Large means approaching a micron or more, and well-ordered means coherently ordered to high resolution over the entire length of the crystal. Well, what you do in this case is then you would combine really make use of the power of the microscope, right? By collecting two data sets. One would be an image data set that gives you phasing information. That would be the equivalent to the crystallographers in X-ray crystallography doing, you know, a heavy atom derivative or anomalous scattering experiment and whatnot to generate some phase information. The only difference is our phases are very accurate as we get them from the images. And you would collect a second data set where you basically circumvent the objective lens. You just cut that out of the loop and make the diffraction pattern conjugate with the imaging plane. So Linda has been talking about this earlier in the week, right? How in the microscope you can choose whether you record diffraction patterns or images. Now, the diffraction patterns in themselves are similar to X-ray diffraction patterns in that they faithfully record an intensity, but they have no information about the phase structure of the object. So why would you want to do this? The reason why you would want to do this is that if you image, your image-derived amplitudes suffer from the CTF contribution, the envelope of the microscope, and they get very weak as you go to higher and higher resolution. The diffraction amplitudes don't, because even if you have movement in your crystal, it doesn't really matter. You just look at what is it. Remember, the diffraction pattern is translation invariant. You just measure the diffraction pattern of tens of thousands of molecules, which gives you a relatively good average of what the amplitude ought to be, much more accurate so than you could derive from an image, because you could simply not process an image that big in a reasonable amount of time, because calculating these Fourier transforms does get longer. It's not like what Richard said, right? When they were starting this in the 70s, they would start the Fourier transform of a 2,000 by 2,000, 4,000 by 4,000 on Monday, and it would calculate until Friday, right? Now, these days, you do this in about a minute or so, right? But still, if you had, let's say, a 50 or 16,000 by 16,000 image and you wanted to transform this, right, every computer would say, not with me, okay, I'm on vacation. And that is the difference why you couldn't achieve really very accurate amplitudes from very large imaging arrays. And you wouldn't want to, actually. So that's... Oh, yeah, okay. Maybe we can do this over coffee, so because otherwise we really start. We talk, I seek you out, okay? Michael? Okay. Right. So the answer to the first question is no. And the reason why not is that if you have a tiny 3D crystal, just about a micron, so that it would be suitable to mount in a microfocus beamline, right, you have about 10 to the 15 molecules in there. Now, an average two-dimensional crystal would have about 10,000 molecules. Right? So if you were to put a two-dimensional crystal in an X-ray beam, it just sits open to history, okay, and you will get no signal. I mean, there are these people out there that have the big vision, right, that you have synchrotron that's extremely bright, and then you shoot single molecule through the X-ray beam and collect the free transform from individual particles, right? Once that happens, we may discuss that problem again, right, that you shoot two-dimensional crystals through the beam and try to collect whatever you see there, right? But until then, you would just not have enough mass scattering power there. Right, plus the experiment would be convoluted by the fact that your transform is sort of smeared out in a certain dimension. So you actually, the X-ray experiment is nice because it's a sample transform in all directions, right? Which, you know, with a two-dimensional crystal you don't really have. So the second question is, can you extend electron microscopy to a three-dimensional crystal? The answer to this one is no again, right? For two reasons. The first reason is that the three-dimensional crystal is multi-layered, so you quickly approach the thickness where the electron beam can penetrate. You could circumvent that by going up in voltage, but the problem is that the thicker your crystal gets, the more secondary scattering you get. And the more secondary scattering and tertiary scattering, much of the scattering you get, the less you're able to interpret actually what you're looking at. Right? So that's the first reason. The second reason why you can't do it on 3D crystals is that you actually lose the power of the microscope, that every single projection will show all of the reflections every single time if you have a good crystal. If you have a 3D crystal, then you get a sampling function along the third dimension. So instead of having discrete diffraction spots like what we would see in a three-dimensional crystal diffraction pattern, a sort of blur catching peaks, right, that depending on how many layers you have, will get narrower. Now, let's say you have a 10-layer crystal. You actually have to know what the distance is between them to predict what tilt geometry you need to sample the information along the third dimension. Right? The beautiful thing about the 2D crystal, it's perfect for lazy people. You just tilt and collect what you get, and later you fit a curve and what the heck, okay? With the 3D crystal, you would have to actually predetermine what the in-plane orientation of your crystal is. You would know what the third dimension axis is, and you have to pre-calculate actually how much to tilt, right, so that you sample that exact measurement, right? That would be very difficult, right? I mean, people have tried that, like David Stokes' group, and they have some very thin three-dimensional crystal as the paint, right? So it's not really generally applicable, and this is why people, if they find they have more than two layers that are related by a two-fold axis, they just, you know, take the Abendorf tube, walk it to the trash can, and forget about the project, you know, such. Yeah. It's very hard. No, it has been done, right? So people have tried, right? Because, yeah, of course, it's an instrument that gives you direct phases, right? So you don't have to go through all the hoops, right? But it certainly gets a lot more challenging, right? So it would need people who are really dedicated to figure out how to tie this into the compute stage, determining if exactly tilting it there so that you're not landing next to your thing. So I think it could be done, but how useful it is right now is not really much. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to talk about this more on Monday, but the point is that you say the bottom line is the flipping is the most important, you know. So if you take an X-ray structure that is perfectly refined, and you reset all amplitudes to 1, you just get the same structure anyway, okay? So that basically means that if you were to start filtering, right, and doing amplitude adjustments, the way the 2D people deal with this, you just divide by the CTF, and the maximum scale you apply is 5 because you don't want to explode, right, close to the zero, and it works remarkably well because you have very accurately determined phases that tell you how you should be weighting this, which is something the single particle people have but don't use, right? They have the phase information but hardly ever make any use of it, right? And that's why you have to be more finicky if you want to do any amplitude scaling there, right? Because you're basically fishing in the black, right, in what you're doing. Yeah. Right. Yeah, see, so the thing about crystals is that you have no, so what you're looking at is not a signal of a single molecule. You look at the signal that comes from the entire crystal. So it's the average of all the unit cells, right? And that is the very reason why we have no size limitations in the crystallography. You can have a 10 kilodalton protein, you can solve the crystal structure just fine. Whereas, you know, doing a single particle on a 10 kilodalton protein, well, good luck.
There is a vending machine upstairs that people are successful with the soda or something like that. We need your evaluation form.
Atomic layer 2D crystal. So in that case, you couldn't have enough signal in the pre-atomic
form. Let me just take your assessment, we can talk about this.